Welcome to Ron Idle's The Good Cop, a compelling true crime podcast based on the TV series of the same name from Foxtel's Crime and Investigation channel. Ron Idle's is Australia's greatest detective, having spent more than 40 years with the Victorian Police, 25 of those with the Homicide Squad. During that time, he investigated over 320 murders and achieved a 99% conviction rate. Homicide was his life. This podcast series takes you inside some of Ron's most challenging cases and shares Ron's secrets, mantras, and the unique thinking that guided his investigations. Join Ron on his journey in Ron Idle's The Good Cop. Episode 6, Maria James. Every family deserves answers.
I was only 26. I'd been at the Homicide Squad probably a week. Brian McCarthy was my senior sergeant. We're sitting in the office when the phone rang. Brian took the call, looked out over his glasses, wrote some notes, got off the phone, and then he said, "We've got a job." And that was just the terminology that meant that we had a homicide. This was my first one. And he told me that there was a lady called Maria James who had been found in a bookshop in High Street, Thornbury. As a young boy growing up, all I ever wanted to do was be a homicide investigator. And I used to watch the original Homicide series. And I was fascinated as to how they could solve a murder inquiry in an hour. And I thought, you know what, that sounds exciting. And ultimately, that's what I went on to do. And here I was, finally at my first homicide investigation, the murder of Maria James. It was a single-fronted shop. There were books displayed on both sides of the door. There were stacks of magazines, stacks of books. And then you walk to a door, and you open that door, and straight to the right of that door was her bedroom. I can still visualise her on the floor now. There's white shag pile carpet. There's blood all over the carpet. Her hands are tied with hay band. These are horrific injuries and an horrific crime scene. There is absolutely no doubt whoever was responsible would have been covered in blood. This is where someone's lost their self-control. Maria was 38 years at the time of her death. She had two sons, Mark, who was 13, and Adam, who was 11. And she was running this second-hand bookshop. We had to talk to John James, Maria's ex-husband, because he's the one who found Maria dead. And Brian said to him, "Well, how did this happen?" And he says, "I was working at the Fitzroy Town Hall. It was around 11:30 or something like that. She made a phone call to me." She sounded somewhat distressed. She said, "I'm in a spot of bother and I need you to come out here." He said, "I told my PA that I was going out to see my estranged wife. I got in the car and I hurriedly came out to the bookshop. I went to the front door. The front door was locked. So I went around to the back of the bookshop. and it was locked also. So I got a ladder and I went through a window. I came through the residence of the shop, and then to the left is the bedroom right near the entrance to the bookshop. The door was ajar and I looked in. I couldn't believe what I saw. There was my estranged wife, and I knew she wasn't breathing, but there was blood everywhere. I called 000. I came back into the residence, and at that point, the door between the residence and the bookshop was open, and the front door was open. John's saying, well, the only thing is that when I went in there, the killer had to be behind the door because the door from the bookshop was shut and the front door was locked. This was the first homicide that I'd been involved in. There were lots of things to process. And one of the first things that we found was there were two cups on Maria's table. There were two seats there. You're not going to go and make a cup of tea or coffee for someone you're not comfortable with. She's comfortable having a conversation with someone. Then for whatever reason, it deteriorates. So what's happened in that conversation to get it to that point? This is somebody who knows her. This is someone who is upset. Then it's an examination of the scene. And there's exhibits taken. There's a bloody string around or hay band around her hands that's taken. What we discover is there's a knife missing, a stay sharp knife. There is a mark on her face that's zigzagged, and we try to work out what that is. And Brian McCarthy, my senior sergeant, says, that looks like a potato masher. We were actually able to go back and find a potato masher at the house which matched identical the markings to her face. At some stage while she's on the floor, whoever's responsible is holding a potato masher on her face to hold her face down and at the same time is stabbing her. The weapons are from the house. What does that tell you? It tells you this, that the person who went there did not necessarily go there with the intention to kill her. These are weapons that are at the house. The potato masher is from a drawer. The knife is from the knife block. The argument's developed quite clearly. I often say you've got to put yourself into the mind of the offender and the skin of the victim. Recreate that scene and it actually might guide you. And what I learned from that scene was there has to be an emotional connection. This is not somebody who walked in off the street. This is a frenzied attack. Quite often in murder investigations, the estranged husband or those that are very, very close to the deceased are responsible. 98% of murders are committed by someone known to the victim.
Maria Teresa James telephoned her ex-husband to tell him that she was worried about a person in her bookshop in High Street, Thornbury.
So here is a man who says, "Oh, my ex-wife rang me and I found her in the bedroom stabbed." Well, you've got to start with him first. Why is he a suspect? Because he found his ex-wife stabbed. Now, he says, "I got a phone call at 11:30 at the Fitzroy Town Hall." His personal assistant said, "I took the call from his wife. I put the call through to John." So we were able to find people at the Fitzroy Town Hall who put John at the town hall. So on that basis, he was eliminated. In an unusual move, my senior sergeant decided to run the investigation from the bookshop. So we set up an office in Maria's kitchen. Brian McCarthy had a view that why drive into the office and then have to drive out to Thornbury where we could save 2.5 hours a day? So we set up an information caravan at the front of the bookshop. The media was there every day at the start, talking to the locals, even to the parish priest.
The local priest, Father Bongiorno, says he warned Mrs. James that the bookshop and the location did not make for a suitable environment for a single woman bringing up children.
I was concerned about her vulnerability, but I never thought it would come to this, of course.
The public knew that we were operating from the shop. People knew we were there and were happy to come in and share information with us. A man who comes forward, he says, "At 9:10, I'm working at the service station." There was a petrol station opposite. "And I look across and I see a man knocking on the front door of the bookshop. He's got a blue blazer coat on, grey trousers, and he's carrying a briefcase. The door opens and he goes inside. He doesn't see him come out. Who is that person?" Initially, no one knew who it was, but I think from the publicity, someone came forward and said, "He's a man whose name's Mario Valcucci. He lives at 3 Hutton Street, just across the road." So we went to Mario's house. Mario was about 50. He'd never married. He lived with his mother. I remember knocking on the front door, and I think I was with Brian McCarthy. "Say to Mario, what can you tell me about Maria James?" He admitted that he was the person that went there at 9:10. He went there to sell a magazine called The Parade Magazine. They were a magazine from United States of America. A lot of them related to sexual killings, and they were a very, very odd magazine. He said, "Maria didn't want them. I had an argument with her and I left." And then we searched the back of his house and we find hay band identical to what her hands were tied up with. And whilst we're searching his bedroom, we found a receipt, and it was for a dry cleaning service. And we asked him about that, and he said, "Oh, I'd taken my blue jacket in to be dry cleaned." We ultimately went to Fletcher Jones Dry Cleaners, and they verified that he had come in the day after the murder, but they'd noted on a piece of paper within their book possible blood stain to the jacket. So now we have what we think is a pretty good suspect. Maria was 38 years at the time of her death. She had 2 sons, Mark, 13, and Adam, who was 11, and was intellectually handicapped. She was someone who was a devoted Catholic, went to church every Sunday and would take the boys to the church. Mark James is in his early 50s now, but not a day goes by when he doesn't think about his mum.
My mum was about the best mum any child could ask for. Mum was well known in the community. I mean, back then, it was... It's not like it is today, where some of us don't even know who our next door neighbours were. Back then, everyone knew each other, and she was well liked by all.
And Mark keeps the memories of Maria alive for his younger brother, Adam.
And this is a photo of your mum in her wedding dress. Mm-hmm. It was taken just before her wedding.
Right.
And you might remember this one. Mm-hmm. This is a photo. She really looked after us. In everything she did, there was care, there was devotion, there was love. You know, also with Adam, with his mild handicap, that didn't put her off in the slightest. She put every bit of extra effort into, you know, developing Adam and communicating with Adam and ensuring that his needs were met. She was a great mum. You couldn't ask for a better mum. I was just this normal kid living in High Street Thornbury, just like everybody else. And on that day, my life was interrupted and just stopped and became crazy. My mother was dead, but murdered. None of it made any sense.
For Adam and for Mark, the most important thing to them is, I want to know what happened to my mother. They just look at you to think that you're the person who's going to provide that answer. This was a jigsaw puzzle, putting piece to piece together to finally get a picture. But as time went on, I realised it was far more important than that. Those who had passed on didn't have a voice. This was about bringing a voice, bringing some resolution to their family as to why someone would take the life of their loved ones. Just when you start and you think, aha, we've got it, Mario must be responsible, because he had a motive, and the motive was that he was upset that she didn't buy his magazines and he lived around the corner. But then we find a witness who's driving along High Street who sees a man run out of the bookshop on the day of the murder. She nearly ran over him, and she saw that man run into Hutton Street.
This sketch is a likeness of the man police are looking for. They believe someone in the Thornbury area must know him, and they believe he may have frequented the book exchange.
And then the guy at the railway line sees that man run, and he describes him again as having hairy arms, a short sleeve shirt, but his hair is receding. So that is a description given by two different witnesses, which is nearly identical. But their descriptions didn't fit the physical description of Mario. With all the media attention, soon we had more potential suspects to look at. We find out that Maria's told someone, I'm having a relationship with someone who works for Telecom. Who's that person?
We also approached the Catholic priest,
Father Bongiorno, because Maria went to the church there. And we said, well, what about if she's gone to the confessional and she's told Father Bongiorno the name of the person she's having a relationship? That might be the person that's actually killed her.
Just 100 metres from the bookshop where Mrs. James was brutally murdered is St. Mary's Catholic Church. The priest there is Father Anthony Bongiorno. He knew Mrs. James and he's given police what he's described as valuable information regarding the murder inquiry.
Now, all we ever wanted Father Bongiorno to say really was, yes, she confessed to having an affair, at least that much, without going the next step of naming. And he said, I can't divulge anything out of the confessional.
Can you quite categorically say you are not withholding any information?
All I can say is I've given them all the information that they have a right to know.
well, if he knew that she was having an affair, there's a moral obligation to tell us. And I thought he was somewhat bombastic. Someone came forward and talked about a man who was regularly seen leaving the bookshop at 5 a.m. in the morning. Is that the man that she's actually having the relationship with? The boys even know that he's there. We continued on. Astonishingly, we got a call and we tracked down the telecom worker, and he was living in South Yarra. He was taken back to the homicide squad where he was interviewed. He says, yes, I did go there. And he said, yes, I know the bookshop. You can come to my house. There are books that I've purchased from Maria. He denied being in a relationship with Maria. He says, I often spoke to her in the shop, but I didn't kill her and I have nothing to do with her death. So I got the sense that he was being honest. And I was reasonably comfortable with the account that he gave, that he could be probably eliminated at that point, but never exonerated. Would you believe that within 3 days of that interview, he took his own life? He typed up a note on a small Olivetti typewriter, basically saying he'd had enough of this world and that he wanted to basically pass on. There was no reference to Maria James. So there's a man who wasn't eliminated, not totally alibied, but took his own life 3 days after. Was it a case that he was mentally disturbed, he had anxiety, depression? I don't know, but the bottom line is we'll never know. He took his own life. Or did he take it because he is actually responsible? We would work at the bookshop from 7 o'clock till about 11:30 at night. I was living at a place called Launching Place, which was 65 kilometres from Melbourne. So by the time I got home, it was 12:30. I'd get into bed and I'd be gone by 5:30 in the morning. So if you were to ask my wife, she would say, well, he came home and he left and I was left alone. And that's the reality of what it was back then.
For Ron, selected to become a homicide investigator was his dream, and he believes that the victims' families need total support. And I think, you know, it was very draining on them because the families did expect answers. Very quickly. They wanted a culprit. Sometimes their anger fell upon the investigators only because they didn't know where else to point the blame. But I think he really worked hard for the families. He was always like that.
We spent 2 months at the bookshop, and eventually we got to the point where there were other investigations that had to be undertaken. And then from then on, we still worked on it, but not from the bookshop. We went back to the office and we continued on-call responsibilities, and then other murder inquiries came in. So to some extent, it was put to the background, but you continued to work on it when you had time. There were four of us on the crew. I would say three of us believed that Mario Valcucci was probably responsible. But we had no forensic evidence other than he admitted that he'd been there. It was disappointing at the time that I didn't solve it, because I think every family deserves answers. By the early 2000s, I was running the cold case unit at the Homicide Squad. I'd been a homicide investigator for many, many years, but one case which still troubled me, which was always on my mind, was the murder of Maria James. In 1980, there was no such thing as DNA. And then as time progressed, by 2000, DNA was reasonably sensitive. So we had all the exhibits from Maria James' case re-looked at to see if we could extract DNA. There were pillowcases or pillows at the bookshop, and pillowcases were collected back in 1980. Back then, all we could have got was, yes, that's Maria's blood, no further examination. When we reinvestigated it in 2000, those pillowcases were taken to the forensic science laboratory. The biologist then looked at them all, extracted and tested all the material, and came back and we got a report to say, we now have DNA of the male person who we believe is the offender. So as a result of the DNA on the pillowcase, we made up a list of previous suspects. We then went around to obtain their DNA and, where possible, eliminate them from the investigation. So I went back to Mario Valcucci, who was in a nursing home. But his sister gave me permission to get his DNA. I always thought that Mario was a pretty strong suspect. I checked the DNA against the profile and he was eliminated. There were several other people whose names were in the file. I think by probably 2006, 2007, whilst we'd slowly worked through the list, we were to the point where it was square one. Everybody who we thought might have been involved had been eliminated. Admittedly, we didn't get the DNA from the telecom worker. He'd been cremated. But on the whole, we were satisfied that all the suspects who'd been nominated were eliminated. It got to the point was, well, that's it. There's not a lot else we could do. Then out of the blue, popped up another suspect. It was someone who knew Maria. It was her parish priest, Father Bongiorno.
All I can say is I've given them all the information that they have a right to know.
Keith Moore from the Herald Sun was always someone who was passionate and wrote stories about unsolved homicides. He wrote two or three different stories around the Maria James murder from 1980, how fascinating it was, and eventually he wrote a story that Father Bongiorno had been charged with paedophilia.
Father Bongiorno had indeed been charged with a number of sexual offences, and he was actually acquitted of them because of a legal technicality. But some years later, the Catholic Church accepted the stories of the victims and paid compensation out. So certainly the Catholic Church viewed him as a paedophile.
Mark James remembers the article well.
The 2007 article was something that the Herald Sun did that first brought Bongiorno into the public limelight about being a suspect in Mum's murder. But it was 2013 when a distant family acquaintance got in touch with me and she asked me, oh, look, you know, did Father Bongiorno ever do anything to you? And I just told her, no, he didn't, just handing out chocolate bars to entice kids, sitting me on his lap, just that. I mean, because nothing happened. Then she suggested to me, well, perhaps maybe he may have done something to Adam. Would you ask Adam? And it was in a week or so later, I was taking Adam out to lunch. We were going to go to the local pizza shop there and grab some lunch together, and I put it to him, did Father Bongiorno ever do anything strange to you? Did he ever touch you in any way? Adam said, yes, and he pointed down to his private parts. In that moment, it's like the feeling that you have when you have a car accident or when you're in a plane and your engine stops. Time slows down. I was hit by a ton of bricks. I couldn't believe it. I'm sitting there in the car trying to take this in, thinking, shit.
He was behind the altar and he said to me, it was kind of in a abrupt way, you know what I mean? Adam, I don't want you to tell your mom or Mark what I'm going to do to you. Then I said to him, what are you doing? Then I asked him to stop. He wouldn't stop.
Adam said, I later told my mother, but I didn't tell Mark. I told my mother. She went over to the church and challenged him about the fact that he'd sexually assaulted me. He wasn't happy.
What happened in that morning, when she was making breakfast, she was standing at the stove and she said to me, if anything ever happens to me, make sure that you look after your brother. In retrospect, with the benefit of hindsight, it was clear to me that she was afraid, that there was something going on. She felt in danger. You know, I then had breakfast and went to school like any other day, completely devoid of the knowledge that anything had transpired.
After Adam came forward, we had a motive. The motive clearly could have been, let's silence Maria. But Father Bongiorno died in 2002. The only way to eliminate him from this investigation was to obtain DNA from a relative. And he had a sister. And I explained to her that the paper had written articles about her brother, indicating A, he was a paedophile, B, he'd sexually assaulted Maria's son, and he potentially may have been involved in Maria's death. She said, I won't give it to you. So we were then hamstrung about trying to eliminate him.
My wife, Colin, knew how frustrated I was.
Ron always used to say that he hated the jigsaw being not finished. He needed to put in that last piece, and that's what a cold case to him was, to find that the closure for the family.
Then all of a sudden, Rachel Brown, a journalist from the ABC, came along. She reinvestigated and stirred it up. She interviewed hundreds of people and she put together a podcast called Trace.
I approached Mark and Adam James early March 2016 and asked for their blessing to look into their mother's cold case. Mark graciously said, yes, I'd like you to look into it because I've always had these niggles about Father Bongiorno, and so if you can look into that, that'd be great.
Adam has an exceptional memory. Now, he says the day of the murder, he overheard part of a phone conversation that the mum had said to him, I'm going to call Father Bongiorno. She'd complained to the church and wanted to take this further. That's the Tuesday morning my mum was murdered.
Other priests were brought up in the podcast that Rachel Brown did for the ABC. One was Father O'Keefe, who also assaulted Adam.
You've got Father Bongiorno, Father O'Keefe at the same parish, sexually assaulting my brother, there's a possibility of collusion between these two priests.
Now, Ron Edel says that men of the cloth were never doubted, you know, back then. You wouldn't think that they were capable of pedophilia, let alone murder. So he was someone that was never questioned as a suspect. And he was really resistant to helping police in the early days. I understand later on he became a little less so, but still unable to reveal who the killer was.
We had no evidence that there were two priests involved. But not long before I left the homicide squad, an electrician came forward with new information. The electrician says, I was working at the presbytery, which adjoins the church. I saw Father Bongiorno shortly after 12 o'clock, covered in blood. I said to him, what's happened? Father Bongiorno said, I fell in the rose bushes. He said, well, come to my van and I'll clean you up and wipe the blood off you. He said, I turned around, the next thing is, he was gone. I never thought any more about it until I read the article that Father Bongiorno was a pedophile, and all of a sudden for me, as the electrician, the penny dropped. Hang on a minute. The day of the murder, I saw him covered in blood. Now, he says, I'm not mistaken about it. So all I'm saying is that is a factual statement which in any homicide case you would wish for. It's nearly the smoking gun.
Keith Moore from the Herald Sun also kept following the case closely.
My view is the only way 100% to exclude Bongiorno is to exhume him and get his DNA and to compare it with DNA they believed they had of the killer from the blood on the pillow slip in Maria James' bedroom.
In 2013, Victoria Police started to re-look at the case. And what happened was they went back to the exhibits and the exhibit that had the DNA of the killer on it. Going back through some handwritten notes, they found, to their shock and horror, that pillar didn't belong to Maria James' crime scene. Because when you go back to the original crime scene, there are only four pillows there. When we tested it in 2000, there's five pillows. Now, that was unbeknown to us. We get a result which says we have the profile of the killer. All of a sudden, there's been a mix-up.
Victoria Police say that the DNA bungle happened because the exhibit from an older case was sitting on a shelf beside Maria James' exhibits bag, and that someone put it into her bag.
So Victoria Police have come out and said that due to human error, we do not have the DNA of the killer. Nobody is eliminated from the investigation, which means we are at square one. Every potential suspect is still back in the frame. I think you have to work on what the facts are. So this is not my opinion. This is relying solely on independent facts. Adam James was sexually abused by Father Bongiorno and has made a statement. Maria James confronted Father Bongiorno about that assault. Mark says that there was a phone conversation on the morning of her death between her and Father Bongiorno. We have the electrician who says, I saw Father Bongiorno covered in blood. on the day of the murder shortly after. I think on the balance of probabilities, at least, Father Bongiorno is responsible.
You know what? More than anything, I would have loved to have solved this case for Maria's sons. We've remained in contact, and Mark and I have visited his mum's grave together.
Here it is, here it is here.
Loving. 17th of June 1980.
Yeah, it's a date, Ron, that I'll never forget.
No. It's a date probably that I'll never forget, but for you it's totally different. Sadly, tragically, someone took your mother's life. Even though we're probably 37 years on, I think I always live in hope. It doesn't matter how dark it is, the stars will still shine. So there is somebody out there, who knows. We need that person to come forward to unlock the door and to finally give you and Adam the answers that you deserve. And it's an honour for me to stand here today with you.
Thanks,
and to respect such a beautiful mum.
Thank you very much.
And I hope that someone comes forward.
Me too.
And finally gives you that peace that you both deserve.
Ron Eddles has been on this case from day one. It was his first case. He's dedicated to it. He's given me hope. He's given me encouragement. And he's been fantastic. You know, I cherish the relationship with Ron.
I have a saying, and that is, every family has the right to have an answer. They've got the right to justice. They've got the right to actually know what happened to their loved one. I often listen to people talk and they say, well, they've got closure. Nobody gets closure. What we want to do is actually give the family an answer. They want to know why they lost a loved one, how it happened, who's responsible. That's never going to bring closure, but at least they have the answers about what happened to the person who has lost their life.
And that ends this podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe and review it via the iTunes Store or your preferred podcast app. Want more true crime? Foxtel's Crime and Investigation channel is dedicated to award-winning local and international true crime documentaries. Visit citv.com.au to find out more. Thanks for listening.